What's my most favorite thing to do? To talk. Every week I'll do just that. We'll feature national and international movers and shakers, experts in their fields, and all around interesting people with something more than great to say. No holds barred. We'll tackle every topic imaginable, especially for women over 40. This is Conversations with Sima. Please stay tuned.
It's the joy of motherhood. Those little ducklings run around in the line. I'll do what any other mother would, to try to do best at bringing them on. It's the joy.
We're talking today with a former teacher, lifelong learner, and freelance writer, Avital Norman Nathman. Her work, which places a feminist lens on a variety of topics, including motherhood, maternal health, gender, and reproductive rights, has been featured in numerous publications, including Cosmopolitan, Redbook, and the New York Times. She writes a monthly column for MyMBiolic site Grok Nation. Her first book, The Good Mother Myth, Redefining Motherhood to Fit Reality, has been considered groundbreaking in its attempts to bust myths and support women in their pursuit of motherhood. Avital just wrapped up a stint as a contract employee with the Yale School of Public Health, where she has helped launch a research-based prenatal education program. Avital lives in Western Massachusetts with her husband and son. So welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me, Sima.
So much has been made of your groundbreaking book, The Good Mother Myth. Tell the listeners why you were compelled to make it, what purpose you hoped it would serve, and now that you've had a couple of years to reflect on this, whether you were pleased with the end result.
So I am a freelance writer, and at the time, I was also a new mom. My son is now 10, but when he was born, we had just moved. I had found myself a little bit isolated. I didn't have my community around me. And so those beginning few months, years, while I was also creating community as a new mother, it was difficult. And I started noticing around me how society, mainstream media, portrayed mothers as I was looking elsewhere to kind of find my tribe, so to speak. And I noticed that whenever they talked about mothers, it was in some sort of exaggerated or kind of fanciful way, in a stereotype, either in a great way, the perfect mother, think of June Cleaver, think of those ideals from like the 50s that we saw, you know, from the television, Lassie's mom. And the other end, you had the moms that failed, mothers that abandoned their children, mothers in jail, mothers suffering from mental health issues, which were always portrayed in a very unfortunate way. So I was frustrated by that. I was wondering, where are all the stories of mothers I see in my community, I see around me? I'm not seeing that nuance. I'm not seeing those narratives being played out up there. And then I believe it was Newsweek magazine that came out with a cover that said, "Are you mom enough?" But don't quote me on Newsweek. It was one of the main magazines, either Newsweek.
Yeah, I remember that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was a woman. I mean, the cover itself is seared into my mind. It was this beautiful white blonde woman standing up with her toddler son, maybe 4 or 5, standing up on a chair nursing from her. And with the caption, "Are you mom enough?" That was inflammatory. I saw that cover and I was just like, you've got to be kidding me. This magazine is basically taking the concept of the mommy wars, splashing it on their cover. And then I read the article and the article was fine. It wasn't inflammatory. It wasn't controversial. It wasn't even, it was an article on motherhood. Nothing we hadn't seen before, you know, it wasn't anything groundbreaking. But that cover was, right? That cover was so divisive and people were so angry. And I personally was like, this is not fair. We're putting those covers out there when mothers are struggling, and that's not what the real mom wars. The real mom wars are the fact that we don't have paid maternity leave, the fact that we have a high rate of maternal mortality in the U.S., and that we're not talking about that. And I get those don't make for sexy, controversial page clicks or magazine buys, but that's what matter to moms. And so I started talking to other mothers, and so I wanted to write a book about it. And then I said, well, that's just as bad, right, for me to put my one opinion out there. And I said, what if I found a way to gather up stories of other women whose stories we don't see in the mainstream, but that these are women and these are mothers that are out there that people can connect with? And so that's what I did. I reached out to my small community, and from there it kind of blossomed, and I started looking for submissions for people to tell me their stories, and organically they started coming in and kind of creating their own categories. Naturally, I saw essays that fit into this idea of a bad mother, right? Like if you had just heard the topic, you'd think, oh, that's a bad mom. We had one woman wrote a story about being a non-custodial parent, which we don't talk about, but there are mothers out there who do not have custody of their children, but they're still mothers. They're still good mothers, but their stories don't get represented. We have a whole section on mental health and mothers and mental health and the very real reality that women and families go through, whether it's PPD, whether it's being bipolar, whether it's garden variety depression that maybe occurred even before having children and then deciding, should I even have a child because I have depression? Because these myths of being a good mother are so strong that even pre-pregnant people are worried they're going to fail before they're even pregnant or with a child. So I really wanted to combat these myths with real stories of mothers. And my son's now 10. I said this started when he was much younger. A few years out, I feel like this book is just as important. The stories in it are just as important. There's a story about being a good black mother that I think people need to understand and read. Tope Fadaran's essay in the book, and she writes this kind of a day in the life that she experiences and how different it is being a black mother. And I think that it would be eye-opening to a lot of people who might have an idea but might not have the right idea. Does that make sense?
Sure. And I can say for myself that I know exactly the cover that you are writing about as someone who has spent more than 8 years trying to bust the myths of midlife motherhood and women choosing motherhood over 40. I think the thing that enraged me about the cover was that mothers come to this place in a variety of other ways, not biologically, but adoptive, foster, guardianship, IVF, surrogacy, and somehow that seemed in that moment to be overlooked as well. Do you agree?
Oh, certainly. I mean, there was definitely a very particular aesthetic and like idea they were going for. They were going for a little bit of a hippie crunchy mother who breastfed her kid till he was 10, and, you know, they even dressed this young boy up in, I think, not army clothes, but in camouflage. You know, he definitely looked older than he was.
Sure.
They were going to evoke a certain feeling, and they got it. I mean, listen, that cover was plastered across, the week after it came out, was plastered across every Good Morning America, The Today Show, The View. I mean, everyone talked about it. They got what they wanted, but what good came of it? Right? Did any positive change for moms actually come out of that article? No, it didn't.
I think the underlying aspect of so much of this is really talking about shame and motherhood, which is something that I've written myself a lot about. I once did an essay on the pecking order of becoming a mother. And I guess I also want to ask you, what are your feelings, both in retrospect and before you started the book, about the issue of shame and motherhood?
Oh, it's strong.
It sure
and I
is.
And I think, you know what? There's no way to win. I had my son young. I was in my early 20s when I got pregnant. It was planned. We tried for a year. I feel like that needs to be a caveat because people automatically have a prejudice against young mothers, just like they have a prejudice against old mothers,
sure.
Right?
Yes.
If you don't have the right number of children, there's shame in that. I only have one child, and we have certainly heard how we're damaging our son by not providing him siblings. And then, of course, families that have too many, you know, kids get shamed as well for bringing too many children into the world, and how are you going to provide for all of them? Every single aspect of motherhood carries with it the potential for shame. How we feed our children, how we discipline our children, what type of education we provide for them, what sort of opportunities, do we work, do we not work? Is there someone at home? Are there babysitters or nannies involved? And it's no coincidence that this is something that's specifically targeted to women, because men don't have that, right? Men and shame, it's very different.
Yes, it is.
I mean, men get some shamed around like machismo and masculinity. I feel like that's a valid topic. But in terms of parenting, never. If anything, you get, oh, my husband made breakfast today, and everyone's rushing to give the man a pat on the back. And it's like, I make breakfast every day, lunch and dinner. And nope,
yes.
You know. But if I forget to do dinner one night, it was like, oh, well, what was wrong with you that day?
Yes.
And so it's all wrapped up. It's that there's sexism, there's misogyny, and it's part and parcel. And so when we talk about motherhood, you can't separate the idea of shame. And I think a lot of us kind of take part in it, right? We are uncertain about our own choices to a degree, and it can be a lot easier to kind of fall in line and be like, well, I made this choice, they made that one, that's bad, my choice is good. Because we're not getting support from anywhere.
Yes.
So it's understandable. I'm not saying it's the right choice when people go against or call out women for making choices other than they make for themselves, but it's understandable.
So my creation of all of the midlife mother work and all the entities that I did actually came out of some amount of anger and mm-hmm. actually, in retrospect, some amount of defensiveness. Was
sure.
the creation of the book coming from anything like that as a new mother?
I don't know if I was defensive, but I was definitely angry. I was definitely frustrated. And there was a sense of, I just want to make sure there are other people out there so that when I write about feeling nothing during those first few months, like I had an apathetic feeling. It's strange to say, and it's kind of oxymoronic that I had an apathetic feeling, but you know, you're told what you're supposed to feel. You're supposed to feel amazing and wonderful. And for a little bit of time, I felt numbness. That's not how a good mother should be. Like they should really, like something's wrong with me. And there wasn't. It just happened to be where I was in that moment. And when I put that book out, maybe this was a little selfish of me, hearing people every time I did a book reading or I wrote about it online or someone contacted me, I always heard stories from folks that said, that happened to me, or you wrote something that I have been thinking and you were able to verbalize it. So it made me feel less alone, and then it made me feel glad that other people were feeling less alone. So definitely creating the book was, in some parts, anger, just frustrated with how women and mothers were being portrayed, and really wanting to saturate the media with more stories, with more nuanced stories, with not clickbait stories, with, you know, not sensationalizing stories. I mean, there are stories that very easily, in the wrong hands, from the book could be sensationalized without a shadow of a doubt. But that's not the purpose. The purpose is to just show these true stories and so that a mother anywhere can pick up the book and say, I might not relate to all of them, but just being able to relate to a few makes me feel less alone, less different, and maybe even less afraid or less self-punishing, right?
Right. So you made the comment that you felt that the book was really just a starting place. Now that you have the retrospect to really look at what kind of impact it's had, how do you feel about it now, and how do you feel about what obligation you might have to the readership to continue the same message?
Sure. I mean, a lot of people asked me as soon as the first one came out, okay, when's the second volume coming out? And well, I would love to. There's so many great stories out there. I'm just not in a place career-wise to do a second volume. So what I do instead is I try my best to uplift and promote other voices.
Yep.
So whether that's through social media, whether it's I find an article that maybe isn't getting the love it deserves, so I try and promote that. I promote things on my Facebook page or within just my articles, right? I try and find, if I'm looking for sources, I try and find women's sources instead of men. Even if it has nothing to do with gender, the article. But just trying to find ways to elevate the voices of women and mothers in particular is a goal of mine in my work, regardless of beyond the book. So the book was a great stepping stone for that, but it's something I try to make sure I do in my work every day.
So before I go forward and talk about what you're doing in the present moment, you've been quoted as saying that the idea of a good mother is a red herring that actually distracts us from the real issues like maternal mortality rate, the potential upcoming demolition of the healthcare system, how this is going to impact pregnant folks. I mean, this is like a landmine. I'm okay if you really choose not to discuss our president, but I'm asking you in a generic way, how do you feel that we should be approaching this subject in this point in time?
Certainly. I mean, like I said, the cover got lots of views, lots of clicks, lots of coverage. But what came out of it? What policy changes came out of it? What program changes came out of it? And the same goes for when I see the stories of moms' mental health being talked about or PPD. So you wrote this story or you presented this 5-minute clip where you followed a couple of moms. Then, you know, did you follow it up by looking at various states and what kind of policies they have in place to help women with PPD? What kind of organization? How are they teaching doctors? How are they teaching pediatricians to catch the signs of PPD in women? Because those are usually the first people that see a new mom, even before their OBGYN or midwife sees them 6 weeks postpartum. And so the red herring is that we can talk about these mommy wars. We can talk about all of these things because I understand that they generate a response. But we need to go that one step further, right, and take that content and figure out how it can actually affect change. And I know it's not sexy to talk about maternity leave, but we need to find ways to do it because these are real issues. There are real lives at stake, especially when we talk about maternal mortality, right?
I'm reminded of a segment that I did with Ann Crittenden and Valerie Young on public policy and mothers in the United States. I did this probably 6 months ago, and how Ann was bemoaning the fact that after all is said and done, so very little has really changed on so many fronts. It seems amazing to me. And again, we're at that same sort of pivotal point where people are starting to uprise and air their voices and show their support, and yet the same cog of the wheel keeps turning the same way. You have thoughts about that?
I do, and unfortunately, I almost wonder if something truly devastating has to happen. I mean, devastating things are happening already, but on such a macro level before our politicians will realize something has to be done. I mean, look just for instance at maternity leave, right? That's an easy one to kind of parse apart. We're one of only a handful, less than a handful, four countries that don't have some sort of government-mandated paid maternity leave. I mean, there are countries that one would not expect would have their acts together to implement this, but yet they are, and the U.S. doesn't. And that just is mind-boggling that we talk so much about family values, but then we do nothing to actually support them.
Why do you think that is?
You know, I think it's a really complicated issue. I think a lot of it has to do with our government, not necessarily even this administration. I mean, we had 8 years where a mandated maternity leave would have been great. Federal employees do have maternity leave. I mean, we'll see if that gets overturned. But at the moment, they do. And that was done under Obama. And so that's great. But we have an entire country that still is behind, right? Some states are, California, for instance, has paid maternity leave and paternity leave, and a few other states as well. And so I think that's one issue, is that part of our government thinks that states' rights are where it should be and that it should be up to the state to decide, which is all well and good, but we can't police every state from where we are, and not every state has the tools necessary to mandate these things. It's the national government that really should be the one to do it. And yet, again, I think it boils back down to, well, it's impacting women. That's not our priority.
It'll be interesting to see, after I noted the sea of white coats and dresses in the sea of people watching the president's speech, to see whether there's really any power that rises up behind this to help change some of these policies.
You know, I'm hopeful. I think, I know you didn't want to get too much into the current administration, but I think that the resistance to the current administration is going to affect some sort of positive change. I think people are waking up. And so whether it's because of Trump and whether it's because he's pushed people into action, or whether it's just they finally kind of woken up and said, wow, we really are lacking a lot of things. You know, I talked earlier about maternal mortality rates. We're one of the only industrialized nations where our rates are going up, meaning more mothers are dying each year than before, compared to where rates are on a whole globally declining.
So I think that's a good segue into what does the rhythm of your life look like now? Tell me what you are doing for work, and ultimately, how do you struggle with combining that career with motherhood and a family?
So I'm still writing. I freelance write. As the Good Mother Myth was taking off, I started working on a contract position at Yale University, where I took data and content and kind of spun it to this consumer-friendly face for group prenatal care. And in doing so, learned so much about maternal mortality and prenatal care than I had ever known before. And my knowledge was pretty decent beforehand because maternal health is in my wheelhouse, but I learned so much more. And so from that, I had the idea to write my next book, The Perfect Birth Myth. And with a colleague from my Yale days, a certified nurse midwife, Deborah Wage, we thought we need to take a look at kind of this pressure to have a perfect birth, right? We talked about perfect motherhood, but what about pregnancy and birth? Because it starts earlier. And we began doing all this research, found really interesting information, and kind of started writing. We have some chapters done, but after the election, we paused. And right now, we're kind of wondering, do we continue or do we wait and see what this new administration what the impact will be on maternal health and on prenatal health and on pregnancy and birth. Because while, sure, nobody is forcing you to write a birth plan, the repeal of the Affordable Care Act is definitely going to have an impact on where people birth, on how they birth, on what type of prenatal care they can access, how much care they can access, how they can afford a birth, right? We know that birth in this country costs between $20,000 to $50,000 per birth, depending on if it's a vaginal birth or a C-section, complications arising. But the average birth costs around, let's say, $25,000 to $30,000. A lot of that is covered by insurance. But when we repeal the ACA, like, where will the chips fall then? How is that going to affect a woman in an inner city in Detroit, where a maternal mortality rate exceeds those of ones in some countries in Africa, for instance? Or how is it going to affect a woman in rural Appalachia? Right. So there's some really real impacts. And so the book is on hold. We're still writing, but we're considering maybe writing a series of essays because people are wondering how will this impact them? And it will. And it's one of the things that makes me really sad that a lot of people could not know that Obamacare, kind of that fear term, and the ACA are the same thing. And they're very quick to say, yes, we don't like Obamacare because it was associated with one person, and then turned around, and a lot of people are now regretting and realizing that meant the coverage that was allowing them to be covered for pre-existing conditions, to have coverage for various illnesses that popped up, things like that. So it's really upsetting. So that's where I'm at right now.
So before we get to another topic, I'm curious about what biggest myths were busted for you in doing this work at Yale School of Public Health.
That women of color are impacted by maternal mortality at a higher rate, and that they're more likely to have prenatal and pregnancy-related complications. And this is for a number of reasons, right? It's too many to go into right now. But that we know of ways that reduce those. So one of those is this group prenatal care, so that instead of going for your monthly and then biweekly and then weekly appointment with your OBGYN or midwife by yourself or with your partner, you go to a group class. So you do the same amount of appointments, but you do them with a group of women and a provider and a facilitator. So you're learning from each other and from a provider, from a facilitator, so you're still getting quality care. And what Yale found and what I found through reviewing the research was that the rates of anything that could go bad went down. So specifically also for African-American women, for black women, the rates of various things like prenatal complications went down almost 40%.
Wow.
Things like low birth weight went down. Mm-hmm. Things like early birth rates went down. So they're delivering babies that are healthier and on time versus earlier and in need of neonatal help.
That's
that
amazing.
Rates of breastfeeding went up afterwards. That rates of next children went down so that people weren't having their next baby is too close. So they learned about things like contraception. So we know that these work. And yet group prenatal health care is not a standard. There's maybe, I mean, don't quote me on this, but I want to say there's around 200 facilities that offer something like this across the country. And so it just boggles my mind that we have an option that works, an option that doesn't take up any more time or effort, really, an option that insurances have been known to cover, because they'll cover it just like a regular appointment, and an option that actually combats these statistics that we're talking about. But yet, it's not being explored, it's not being implemented as frequently as it should.
I think I am continuously scratching my head when I find things like what you've just presented. It makes like no sense that we're not pursuing it, you know?
Right. Well, I think for some people, especially doctors who have grown up with traditional methods, this is different for them. They would have to learn differently. There are different booking issues. I mean, you know, so there are, I understand, but it's not enough. It's not complicated enough to say we know this specific group of marginalized people, black women, are being impacted at a higher rate than other women. What can we do to help? Here's the solution. Why is it not being implemented more frequently? Like you said, it's simple solutions are out there for a lot of things, especially impacting mothers, and yet we don't do that. And that's frustrating, and that's why I'm going to continue writing about these things, and that's why I'm going to continue talking out about these things.
Yeah, that's great. So very quickly, how do you now combine a career with motherhood and now a family? And what do you do to take care of yourself?
You know, it's become cliche at this point, but it takes a village. And I have my village. I only have one child, so I acknowledge that privilege. You know, there's some I don't want to say downsides, there's challenges, but it is innately easier to have one child in terms of being able to do things. I can pack up and head into New York City for work. I can take a plane somewhere and only have one child's schedule, and he's 10, so it's a lot easier than having a younger child. And I will admit, I do a lot more things now with my son in elementary school than I did when he was a baby or a toddler. I have a partner that supports me in my work, even though he has a very ever-changing, difficult, rotating schedule. He still makes it a priority to ensure equality in our marriage and in our careers. And I'm lucky enough to have my folks nearby and a lot of juggling. I mean, and you know, there's going to be parts, the times when one thing gets left to the side. Not everything is going to be balanced. I think balancing is hard. Some things are going to be done better than others, and at other point, things are going to be done worse than others, and that's just how it goes. Got to look kind of long term rather than in the day to day, and kind of ensure that that balance is there. And so, what do? So, I have good friends. I watch crappy TV, CW teen dramas, Riverdale. If you haven't seen that, it's like it's a new version of the Archie comics. It's amazing. But I mean, that, you know, something that I can just sit down and watch and not think about any of these other things.
Yes,
is great. Drag Queen Bingo is my girlfriends and I get together for that once a month, and it's as healing and as soul-satisfying as, let's say, a yoga class to me.
So I would be remiss if I didn't end by saying, I know you love chai tea, and me too. I'm crazy and gaga over it. So my question is, what's your one or two best places to get chai tea?
So I love chai. It's hard because it has black tea, and I've recently become way more sensitive to caffeine. But some great places in my neck of the woods for chai tea. Northampton Coffee has some excellent chai tea. If you're ever in Western Mass, going to visit a college or Northampton Coffee. And believe it or not, this is going to sound so cheesy, but Oprah's chai from Teavana is really good.
I've had it.
They got me with a sample one of the days in the mall, and I was like, you know what? I was so prepared not to like this.
We've been talking today to Avital Norman Nathman. I am so pleased to have had you here. You have reinvigorated the discussion about midlife mothering and motherhood and myths, so I appreciate your coming down to discuss this. Avital can be found at themamafesto.com, her website, and at the same name on Twitter. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40, Conversations with Sima. Thank you so much to the listener for joining us today. And until next time, I hope you take care.
It doesn't matter how long I've had to sit here minding my broom. Those little heads so soft and downy, their baby bods all golden browny, the beaks constantly open waiting for food. It's the joy of motherhood. Those little ducklings bouncing around in the lawn. I'll do what any other mother would, to try to do best at bringing them on.
She'd be better if the father who was better at being the father who is. I sometimes think I've been better off than a beast boy.